NowVeryBad.com presents Now Very Beast, Iron Maiden, The Next 10 Years. Host Michael Ford Feeney. Hello again, and welcome to Now Very Beast, Iron Maiden, The Next 10 Years, Episode 9, NVB09, for those scoring at home, dealing with the first 10 years, Part 9. That's right, we're nearly done with the first series. This has taken a long time, but I'm not apologizing for it. This is great stuff to get through, and this particular installment has a particular meaning for me. This was the first one that I got. So this is where it all began for me. I can't even really judge this one critically, because it's the first inkling I had of what this series was all about, or even that this series existed. I've done a bonus episode where I'm go on for like a half an hour talking about finding this first one and the record shows and how that all came about. So if you're really inside baseball and you really want to check that out, great. But it does free me up to not go into it here about collecting the first 10 years. But this is a great installment, period, because Seventh Son of a Seventh Son is arguably, probably Iron Maiden's best album, the most complete stem to stern album. Now, it's not because it's a concept album, although when I come back to this and we do a full episode on the album and go through each of them, certainly going to be talking about just how much of a concept album this is or isn't, actually, as time goes on, come to realize it's not really that much of a concept record, but it feels like a complete document nonetheless. It's flawless. It has this unified sound and style to it. It's a full album. And so you've got a couple of strong singles, and those stand on their own. They're fantastic. They would feature in many set lists going on. This is one of those albums that really is a collection of tunes that work best when they're all together. There's other things like that, like Sgt. Pepper or And Justice for All, Powerage, Tommy, Sign of the Times, where it's like these are albums that they may or may not be the best album that that band put out, but they're like so seminal, so complete, such a cohesive, complete document. You can't really compare them with anything else in their catalog. And Seventh Son is like that. And reportedly, they actually had kicked around the idea back in 88 of playing this album in its entirety, in sequence, on tour. They absolutely should have done this. That would have been fantastic. They would go on to do that many years later with A Matter of Life and Death, one of their other records that they would come out and play in sequence, play the whole thing, which is really cool, and I really do wish that I had been able to see that live. Nevertheless, would have been absolutely perfect to do here because the crowd would have loved everything about it. Iron Number 9 came out April 9th, 1990, containing the singles Can I Play With Madness and The Evil That Men Do. Reached a chart position of number 10 in the UK albums chart. Can I Play With Madness had first been released as a single March 20th, 1988, and reached number 3 on the singles chart, which it totally should. It's a fantastic single, a fantastic song. And so both the 7 and the 12 came out in March, which was about a month, a couple weeks before the album which was released. Seventh Son of a Seventh Son came out April 11th, 1988. So the 7-inch single, the B-side was a tune called Black Bart Blues, written by Bruce Dickinson and Steve Harris. And if you got the 12-inch, you were much luckier because you got one of the greatest covers they've ever done from one of the great all-time bands, Thin Lizzy, the cover of their tune, Massacre. Can I Play with Madness is... Let's start with the problems with Can I Play with Madness. It probably should have a question mark in the title. That's it. That's what I got. That's the only possible criticism I can make of this. It's one of Maiden's great 1980s tunes. Makes its way into set lists now, and it's fantastic. The only real caveat to that is because the opening of the tune, you know, it starts with an a cappella three-part harmony there. And that's so strong and so tight that sadly, when they play it live, it doesn't totally work. It's hard to do. They're not that kind of band. You know, when they get to the chorus and they do the harmonies, they work pretty well. That's okay, but it's really hard to nail the opening live, and for the most part, they don't. Sad to say. The biggest problem with Black Bart Blues is that it was on the 7-inch single, and they really should have had Massacre on there. Black Bart Blues suffers by being sandwiched between Can I Play with Madness and Massacre. It's not a good tune anyway. It's sort of this uninspired kind of pseudo blues jam thing, but you know, there's really nothing all that much there. It's okay, you know. The lyrics are stupid. It's a beginning of when the jokey tracks kind of started to be a problem for me. This is not a problem, but it's starting to be a problem. They had a suit of armor. Bruce Dickinson bought a suit of armor on one of their tours, and somewhere in the middle of the country found this tacky thing and said, "Oh, this would be perfect in the back of the tour bus." So I guess this is sort of supposed to be something about all the backstage shenanigans that rock stars do and all their crazy sort of naughtiness. And I don't know, it just doesn't really land. It's weird. It's kind of these oblique, weirdly vague lyrics that probably mean something to Bruce, but they certainly didn't mean much of anything to me. And there's this, he does one of his vocal goofinesses to have some character that he's talking to and inviting to meet Black Bart. And I don't know if this is supposed to be a groupie, like this is supposed to be some female conquest or something, but it sounds like nothing so much as a whiny little boy. And that makes the tune even weirder than I think that even Bruce intended. So it's not very good. I mean, the single best thing about the tune, there's some solid guitar solos, and one of them near the end, Dickinson pulls off one of these great lines, goes, "Here comes the guitar solo," which is just kind of a funny thing to say. And I have always enjoyed that much more than the song. At the end of the tune, again, with the goofiness theme, there's all these bits of Nico being goofy in the studio. They recorded this and put it in this track without letting him know about it. He probably didn't even know he was being recorded. So it's all this goofy stuff with him talking on the answering machine at the studio, or all the things he would do singing along to songs as recording them while they were making the album and stuff like that. And it's kind of funny, you know, if you like Nico, which I love Nico's goofiness. It was a lot of fun the first time I heard it. Second time, maybe it was fun or whatever. The only reason I never got sick of it is because I usually just skip the whole goddamn tune. I just don't particularly care for Black Bart Blues in any way. I don't hate it or anything. It's just not usually worth sticking around for, particularly when Massacre is coming up. I can't imagine how annoyed I'd be if I got the 7-inch, which is probably easier to find, and never realized that I was missing out on Massacre, which is this unbelievable cover. One of the top five covers of, you know, classic tunes that Maiden has ever done, probably. The funny thing about Massacre, actually, is either when listening to this or the original from Thin Lizzy, I didn't realize that this was about the same, you know, that had the same subject that Maiden wrote about in The Trooper, that this is talking about the Battle of the Balaclava in the Crimean War. And, you know, the 600 troops who got bad orders and ended up, you know, going and doing this valiant and noble, but ultimately futile march to their death. Because when you listen to the song Massacre, I mean, it starts off with these really pulsing drums and this melody line that can sort of, you know, if you squint or whatever, it fits in with your preconceived notion about Native Americans. You know, I thought this song was about the plight of the Native Americans, like a run to the hills, because you have that sort of intro. But then, you know, after it goes into what is one of the most enjoyable riffs to play of all time, you know, the main riff that do 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 is just, oh, it's so much fun to play. It's great to listen to, but it's a lot of fun to play. But after that, the lyrics have all these phrases in there, you know, unknown heroes killed like sleeping buffalo through the devil's canyon. You know, there goes the bandolero. I mean, these are words that you think of with the American West. You know, there are even movies called Bandolero. So it feels like a Western, and it's not. It's all about the Battle of the Balaclava. Who knew? The second single, The Evil That Men Do, was put out after the album, about 4 months after the album came out. It was released August 1st, 1988 in the UK, came out on the 13th in the US. It reached five. It started off at number six in the UK and went up to number five, which is, again, probably not unexpected considering how strong of a tune Evil That Men Do is. It also had the benefit that it had, for B-sides, two classic Maiden tunes, Prowler and Charlotte the Harlot, that were re-recorded, and they were called Prowler 88 and Charlotte the Harlot 88. So this was probably more than a curiosity. It was certainly one of the reasons I went and bought this as the first installment in the series, because I was interested in hearing the updates of those tunes. You know, Evil That Men Do already is unassailable. It's a classic. It maybe one of the most age-proof songs they've ever recorded. Never gets old. It sounded just as good when they played it in 88 as when they played it in the middle of grunge in the 90s, as it sounded when Blaze Bailey was singing it, as it sounds decades later. It just always works. Always really happy to see that show up in live sets. Prowler and Charlotte the Harlot, as I say, were updated at this point, and Nico actually refers to it in his Not a Lot of People Know That, which again was the first one I'd ever heard. Nico says that they were thinking about, that he and Harris had been talking about possibly re-recording all the tunes from the first record, maybe even the first couple of records, and doing them with the lineup that they had now at during Seventh Son, which is the class, this is the legendary lineup. And oh, my mouth was watering. I was so excited by this prospect. John was really excited about this because at that point, he wouldn't listen to anything that Dickinson didn't sing on. So I was really, really pumped for this, and they didn't do it. And in a couple of the far later episodes, they'll do a similar thing. They'll try and do re-recordings of classics, and it was never as good as this. I love Prowler 88 and Charlotte the Harlot 88, although Charlotte's a tune I liked a lot better when I was younger. But Prowler is fantastic. It's funny, you have to really like that time in Maiden, which I obviously do, but I can certainly understand listening to these 1988 recordings now that they do sound very much of the time, just as surely as the originals sounded very much of their time. So I don't fail to understand when some people may not get the same joy from these as me. The cover on these, I just want to spend a minute here because we're already running long, but I've always had kind of a love-hate thing with Seventh Son's artwork. You know, the album cover itself is weirdly cool or coolly weird, whatever you want to say, but you know, it's definitely interesting. It's this whole surrealist thing, and it's definitely very, very different, and shows, you know, really complicated, detailed, very high quality artwork. It's just a little odd. It's just not ever going to make my top five. It's good stuff. But I don't know if because the album sleeve is so detailed, that Riggs didn't want to spend as much time on the other covers that he did, because Can I Play With Madness, Evil That Men Do, and The Clairvoyant all have more or less the exact same cover, which is just this disturbing, surrealistic picture of Eddie in these weird, torturous positions in front of really plain blue-white backgrounds. It's essentially the exact same background for all three paintings. I think they, because of coloring, you know, after the picture was printed or something, they look a little bit different, but I'm pretty sure it's the exact same thing. And I don't know, the images are really super detailed, but it's sort of like in the way sketches are really detailed, but the background you just don't even bother doing anything at all for. So it's kind of like that. And I know that at this point, Riggs was getting asked to do a whole lot of ancillary artwork for tours and shirts and all that sort of stuff. And I also know that at this point, I think that their relationship, which was never all that cozy, was really starting to break down. I think he was getting very angry with the deadlines they were imposing on him and the amount of direction, and things were deteriorating. And I think the wheels were about to come off the bus on this one. What's the strangest of all about this is that one of the pieces that he prepared for The Seventh Son, and it's on the inside artwork, it's in the inside of the CD booklet, I think it was on the record sleeve, is one of my very favorite pieces that he ever did. This was put on the sleeve. It was on a poster. I don't think it was ever on a shirt, but it was on this very popular poster that was out at the time. And this is a picture showing Eddie as the prophet, writing into his book by candlelight and staring in the crystal ball. And I loved this piece. This poster hung on the wall in John's bedroom when we were in high school, when we would spend hours and hours there listening to Maiden and watching movies and, you know, learning guitar and all that sort of stuff. And I was transfixed by this image. You know, it's unlike any of the other artwork that he did during that era for Maiden. And it's one of the most subdued images they ever put out. You know, this guy's just sitting there writing and staring into his crystal ball. And because it was so prominently featured on John's wall, I really have come to identify that image entirely with him. You know, that there's something about this, the pose of Eddie, this intensity of his gaze as he's looking into the ball, it just really conjures John's memory completely. Every time I see this thing, I even frequently sort of see John as Eddie in this. You know, I picture John in this exact pose and in this setting, doing what came most naturally to him, poring over waiting, you know, these weighty texts and moody surroundings and recording his thoughts. And I don't even know if it's got a name. I would guess that it's either, you know, the prophet or the prophecy. I've always associated the portrait with that song. You know, the prophecy is one of the most complex and intricate songs on an album full of complex and intricate songs. And unsurprisingly, it was both John and my favorite tune on there. And I would pay good money to get a really high quality print of this piece, or even to be able to stare in that poster, as I did so many times with my friend. Finally, the Listen with Nico on this one, it's no wonder this was a lot to process. This was the first time that I heard Nico doing it, and not a lot of people know that. And so not only was I hearing about this, you know, hearing him talk for the first time when I was listening to this stuff, I was finding out about this series plan for sending in vouchers to get a box set for the first time, as everyone else was. He didn't even get around to talking about that until week 9 of a 10-week series. Sort of a weird thing. But that and the aforementioned bit about the, you know, possible plans to record the classic tunes, I think I ran all the way to Basher's house to tell him about this stuff. You know, after we found this out, we made tracking down the other 9 ones a big priority. And that's it. The rest was history from there. Cheers, everyone.